Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Hockenberry, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The recently foiled bomb plot in Britain came after months of careful surveillance. More than the Americans, the British take the time to wait and watch rather than arrest and prosecute. It's not the way the FBI does it. They're quicker to haul in the net. But some are questioning if we should look across the pond for new strategies of gathering domestic intelligence. Others say if we do, civil liberties will surely get shoved aside. This hour on Point, a 21st century British invasion? No, seriously, domestic intelligence and the push to take a page from the British. Joining me now from London is Rob Watson. He is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. Good day, Rob.
Good morning, John, and good day to everyone.
Bring us up to date on the arrests and the place where we're at and the prosecutions of the suspects in the foiled alleged plot that apparently MI5 was pretty successful in breaking up.
Right. Well, let's try and reduce this to its most basic element. At the moment, 23 suspects are being held in the United Kingdom. No one has yet been charged. They're being held and questioned in London. A huge search for evidence goes on at a number of properties and businesses, and indeed in some woodland in and around the London area. There are several people who have been arrested, allegedly in connection with this alleged plot in Pakistan as well. Now, in terms of those 23 suspects who've been arrested and are still being held, most of them, it's thought, are British, British Muslims of Pakistani descent. And essentially the way it works in Britain, I'd have to get my kind of calculator out in a minute, but the police are allowed to hold them for 28 days from the point of arrest without them necessarily being charged.
And all of these 23 are under that 28-day clock, which we should remind our listeners is a little different way of doing things. I mean, you arrest first and get the evidence later, and that's what's going on here, right?
That's it to some extent. You got to remember, John, this is a bit of an innovation here in Britain as a result. Basically, it's happened in the years following the 9/11 attacks that the British authorities have thought, well, how can we do this? These are incredibly complex investigations. And so they've gradually, over a period of time and negotiations with the British Parliament, come to this period of 28 days where that's the longest you can hold a suspect without actually having to charge them or release them. And exactly a part of the desire of the police and the intelligence services to extend this period, because it used to be just a couple of days, was you know, because these are very tangled investigations involving computer hard drives, often lots and lots of cell phone calls to foreign countries, maybe in some cases suspects in foreign countries. You can see it's not like the old days of, you know, the kind of the old detective novels where, you see the knife with the blood on it and it's all done and dusted.
Yes, those good old days, indeed. Now, it's my understanding that Prime Minister Tony Blair wanted 90 days, but the Parliament resisted.
That's right. What the government was pushing for, headed by the Prime Minister and supported by the head of the anti-terrorism police here in the UK, was for 3 months, 90 days. And their argument, just as I've been outlining it, is, you know, this is fantastically complicated stuff. You know, quite often it involves having to translate things from foreign languages, maybe often Urdu in the case of connections to Pakistan, or Arabic. And the police just say, you know, in an ideal world, this is what we need. And the other point that the Prime Minister and others made was, look, you know, it's not the police arrest someone and then it's you don't hear anything for 90 days. During that 90-day period, that the police would have to make the case to a court as to why continued detention was worthwhile. So it's not as if there was no judicial review. But it was kind of decided in Britain by the MPs that that was just a little bit too long to hold someone.
Well, let's look
without
at the other,
either charging them.
Let's look at the other side of this. I mean, presumably the motive for bringing in these suspects related more to actually foiling the plot that was in some stage of moving forward and protecting flyers traveling from Britain to the United States. How close was this plot, as far as you understand, and whose comfort level was more sort of violated here in terms of how, you know, how close to the edge the
Sure.
British police came?
Well, okay, well, let's take it, because you've raised two interesting points. One, how close were they? Well, I've heard that it was imminent, that it wasn't going to be 1 or 2 days from when they were arrested, but sometime soon, and that there was concern that they had got a method of attack that would have worked. That's the kind of phrase that I heard from the security services. Now, the second issue that you've raised is, well, why did they decide to move? What were the concerns? Now, there's been all this sort of stuff circulating about that the British authorities had wanted to sit on this a bit longer in order to make sure that they had evidence that they could build a good case in court, and that they had been under pressure from the United States on the one hand and also Pakistan to move somewhat quicker, because, you know, there is a slightly different culture. There is a cultural difference here that in the United States, the FBI does tend in these counterterrorism cases to want to move as soon as there's a sniff that these people might be of some kind of danger. Now, what I'm told as to what happened in the UK is that, you know, they were exactly doing this kind of balancing act. On the one hand, the authorities, and what I mean by the authorities is basically MI5, the police, and the government, that they, you know, they were worried that maybe something could go wrong, you could lose sight of some of these people, there would be an attack, and they would all be roundly blamed. On the other hand, they were balancing that against the desire to get an absolute slam dunk case against these people. And I just set this in a little bit of background for you. There was a case where two people had their house stormed a few weeks back in a heavily Muslim part of London. The two men, one of them was shot, they were two brothers, and they were later released without being charged with terrorism offences. So, you know, you've got to put this in that kind of a context. The police, on the one hand, you know, clearly didn't want to take any risks with there being an attack on airliners. On the other hand, they were also under pressure to make sure this time that they found the kind of evidence that would stand up in court.
Well, it's an interesting trade-off, and one that has a very different legal template in Britain than here in the United States. Hold on there, Rob. I want to bring in from Chicago Richard Posner, who is judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. He's the author of Uncertain Shield, the U.S. Intelligence System in the Throes of Reform, along with dozens of other books, including the recently released Not a Suicide Pact, The Constitution in a Time of National Emergency. Thanks for joining us, Judge Posner.
My pleasure.
You think MI5 and the British way of doing things is a really good template for the United States. Could you explain?
Yes. Well, it's not just the United Kingdom. Every country I'm familiar with, except the United States, has decided that it should have a domestic intelligence capability that is separate from the intelligence and law enforcement functions of its national police force, or whatever corresponds to the FBI, like Scotland Yard or like the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And, you know, Mr. Watson was explaining, I think, very well why you want that sort of dual counter-terrorist capability, because the police, you know, they have their culture, their focus on arrest and prosecution. That may lead to premature interventions in terrorist plots. And so you want to have an agency that doesn't have law enforcement responsibilities and can take a different approach. It you know, use other methods of disruption and penetration and so on. And England has a very long history of this. It really goes back to Queen Elizabeth I. And, you know, I think it works successfully. Lots of mistakes, always mistakes in intelligence. But I really don't understand why we don't have a comparable capability.
Now, would this involve changing the Constitution? I mean, essentially suspending certain civil liberties?
No, nothing to do with the Constitution. As I say, the MI5, these other domestic intelligence agencies, they don't have arrest powers. They don't, they can't go around killing people and so on. No, they operate within the law, using surveillance and using the types of disruptive activity which are not illegal. You know, if you penetrate an organization with an undercover informant and then you start making, suggestions that they should be, going somewhere else, doing something else, there's no problem with it. I mean, look, what the FBI does in its stings in drug cases, with informants and disinformation and, cat and mouse games, that's perfectly legal. There's no constitutional or other inhibition. It's just that when they're going after ordinary crimes in that way, they're aiming, as Mr. Watson was suggesting, they're aiming for an early arrest. As soon as they have enough evidence to nail someone, they nail them. That's their business. That's their orientation.
I mean, are the FBI good at this kind of investigation? We've certainly seen that the British have different tactics, but they also seem to have a different expertise in terms of human intelligence, facility with language. Is it more a matter of expertise than it is legal authority?
Oh, I don't think it's really a matter of legal authority. No, let me answer that. I want to correct, if I may, a couple of things you said that I disagree with. First, I don't think, at least as far as I'm concerned, the idea is not that the FBI should create a little MI5 inside it. That's like a whole series of these Russian dolls or something. No, we need something, I believe. We need an agency that's completely separate from the FBI. That's number one. Number two, when you talk about, Big Brother looking over you and so on, that's really not the issue. Surveillance is conducted by the FBI, by the National Security Agency, and so on. So the question is not increasing the amount of surveillance. It's using, it's creating a kind of different organizational culture to deal with these problems. As far as the expertise and the organizational culture, these are really the same thing. Because the FBI is, as a criminal investigation agency, is focused on arrest, prosecution, and so on, it hasn't invested adequately in developing kind of capability involving linguistic skills and techniques of human intelligence oriented toward terrorism.
But there are good reasons for that. I mean, you speak rather
no,
casually about, we have the NSA, we have these surveillance agencies. I mean, it has come as a bit of a surprise to most Americans that we have the capability at the federal level to virtually watch everybody in almost all of their transactions virtually all the time.
That's a surprise? Comes as a surprise? Have you ever bought a book on Amazon?
I have.
Well, don't you understand that when you deal with Amazon, they create a profile of your reading preferences, right? That's called data mining, and that's a way in which these companies learn a great deal about your views, your preferences, and so on, and extend it over the whole range of consumption choices you make.
Right, but do they also know about who I've called and whether I visited Pakistan and all that sort of thing?
Well, certainly the government knows about all your foreign travel because, you have records of your passport and your visas and all that, right? It's stamped in your passport. That's public knowledge. Phone companies have extensive records, obviously, of everybody's calls. We live in an essentially transparent society. And the question that you should ask, because you're obviously concerned about this, is if national security agencies have access to this kind of information in order to, protect the nation against terrorism, is the benefit in more effective counterterrorism outweighed by costs in a further diminution of privacy? That's the question. That question, however, is only distantly related to the question whether surveillance, counterterrorist, domestic intelligence activities should be carried on by the FBI alone. Well, there are other agencies involved, actually, but the FBI is the primary domestic intelligence agency. Or do we need to supplement the FBI with an MI5-type agency? That's not going to lead to more surveillance. It's going to be it's going to lead to a different kind of approach to these problems, with less emphasis on arrest, more emphasis on penetration and patient watching of
Judge, hold on for a second. I want to get one more comment from Rob before we have to leave him. It sounds like what you're saying, Judge, and we can elaborate this on a moment, is to get an agency that's going to aggregate data that already exists out there in multiple locations and use that to the best sort of intelligence gathering purpose. Rob, when has MI5 sort of fallen on its face in British history? And when people in England think about abuses in the pursuit of intelligence gathering, what incidents come to mind?
Well, you know, there are so many, but I'll just give you a couple. I mean, I think in broad terms, MI5 was criticized in certainly in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s for, allegedly infiltrating or trying to undermine trade union groups and nuclear disarmament groups. Now, MI5 disputes that. It says it was only looking for people inside those organizations that were extremists. It obviously also had major egg on its face for failing to detect a bunch of very famous spies from Cambridge who'd gone on to work for the Russians. Very famous case here. And it was also accused by the Prime Minister himself in the 1960s, Harold Wilson, of MI5, accused of trying to undermine him. On the other hand, you balance that against what you would say were some of the MI5's historical successes, and those were, having pretty good idea of what the IRA, the Provisional Irish Republican Army, was up to.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. We are also talking with Richard Posner, who's judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. And I want to bring in Erwin Chemerinsky, a Duke University professor of law and professor of political science. He's the author of Federal Jurisdiction and Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies. Professor, first of all, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of this MI5 model as a way of organizing domestic intelligence surveillance?
I think the key question is it a structural problem that we face, or is it instead an operational problem? I think you could create any kind of agency you want structurally, but if you're not doing the right things operationally, it's not going to help much. My sense is the key problem that's faced right now is much more operational than structural. We don't have enough people with foreign language capacities, especially with regard to the Arabic languages. We therefore have not done a very good job of infiltrating, putting moles within the groups that pose a danger to us. And I think those are the things right now that are most important. So far as we know, the success of the British here was precisely because they were able to cultivate those kind of intelligence sources, and they seem ahead of us on that.
So, Judge Posner, it's not the law, it's the expertise that makes the British more effective. What do you make of that?
No, forget the law. That's not important. No. I agree with Professor Chemerinsky that we have a problem of lacking domestic intelligence officers with linguistic skills. But that is not separable from the structural issue, because the kind of hiring, the kind of emphases, priorities that the FBI was going to set depend on their sense of mission. And if they think of their mission as fundamentally one of arrest and prosecution and so on, rather than patient learning about potential enemies in the United States, they're going to downplay the linguistic skills. So, for example, the FBI does have, like the Scotland Yard Special Branch, it has something called the National Security Branch, which is focused on counterterrorism. Their operations officers, case officers, all of them are FBI special agents, which means they've undergone extensive training in police methods. Now, the people who are selected for that to be FBI special agents among the applicant pool And the people who do well at, you know, Quantico with all their firearm training and so on to be FBI special agents, they're not likely to be people who have particular, you know, cultural awareness or linguistic skills, which are called for in a purely domestic intelligence role as opposed to a police role.
All right. Well, we're going to bring in a caller now from Springfield, Georgia. Phil is calling. Phil, what do you have to contribute?
I just want to say that, you know, I feel safe knowing that they're listening. You know, I think, you know, it may be necessary to establish, like, some type of checks and balance kind of system so that, you know, it doesn't go out of control. You know, I know a lot of lawyers and judges are worried about it, you know, for, I guess, case purposes and information leaks. But as long as there's someone there to, you know, set the standard, you know, we're looking for terrorism, we're not looking for petty little American conversation, which I think they're really not, you know. I don't.
Well, you hope. You hope they're really not, right? What assurance do you have? What confidence? Where do you get your confidence from?
Well, I mean, I have a family member that, you know, that's his job. He works for an agency that listens, and, you know, he talks about, you know, all the petty little things he listens to, and they just, you know, that's not what they're looking for. You know, I just hope, you know, I have a trust, I guess you could say, that I would rather them, you know, bust a few people and cross a few lines and prevent things like 9/11 from happening. You know, I don't really care if they listen to my phone conversation, you know.
All right, Phil, well, thank you very much.
Yes, well, let me say,
I mean, it sounds like he has firsthand experience as well as trust. Go ahead, Judge.
No, I agree with that. I agree with what he said, and let me just elaborate the question of safeguards, because, you know, Phil is obviously aware that we need to have safeguards, and I think two things are very important. I think we want to have a rule that any electronic eavesdropping for purposes of national security, any interceptions of emails or phone calls made for national security purposes, can only be used for those purposes. So suppose, you know, the way this...
But,
this,
I mean,
of,
given the problems with the FISA courts and everything that's been in the news about abuse and just flagrant sort of ignoring FISA court rules that's now being, you know, decided in court, I mean, how can you say that that kind of oversight is even possible?
No. There are two different types of what you're calling abuse. One is the legality of the surveillance being conducted by National Security Agency, whether it complies with FISA, whether it has to comply with FISA, whether it's within the inherent power of the president to defend the United States or what. That's a, you know, complicated legal issue. The abuse I thought you were concerned about and discussing with Phil is that people, intelligence officers who monitor conversations and emails, might use the information they learn for improper purposes.
Well, I'm certainly a little concerned that his friend is sharing conversations with Phil. I don't know what's going on there, but...
Yeah, I mean, obviously... No, I think you want to have strict rules that conversations that are intercepted for these purposes may not be used for any other purposes, including, you know, other criminal prosecutions. So... the way this works is you have computer screening that isolates a tiny handful of suspicious conversations or emails, and then you have an intelligence officer who listens or reads. Now, if that
Let's get a comment from Professor Chemerinsky. Is that how it works?
Well, let me finish. If the intelligence officer, having been, you know, cued by the computer to listen to a conversation, if he decides there is no national security threat here, but he learns that this person doesn't pay his taxes or doesn't pay child support, I would not permit that information to be turned over to the FBI or local law enforcers. And I think people like you would feel more secure if you were assured that the only thing that could get you in trouble would be if it turns out you are, in fact, a threat to national security.
Professor Chemerinsky?
I agree with Judge Posner's main point that law enforcement has traditionally been focused on solving and perhaps preventing crime by deterrence, but but it hasn't been sufficiently focused on trying to gain the information to keep things from happening, and that's where we need to focus. The problem that I have with the distinction that Judge Posner just articulated is I don't want the police coming through my house and searching my things, even if there's nothing that would ever be used as evidence against me. I don't want the police listening to my phone conversations without probable cause and a warrant, even though I have nothing to hide.
Why not? Why does that bother you?
Well, what's the stopping point, Judge Posner?
No, that's a different question. That's a different question. What bothers you about having...
No, I didn't know. Let me just finish real quick. I don't want the police to be able to ruffle through my papers, go through the drawers of my bureau, even though I've never committed any crime and have nothing to hide.
I know. I'm asking you why that bothers you.
Because I think I have a sense of privacy that is shared by most people and that I really believe was the core of the Fourth Amendment. I think that the Fourth Amendment was a notion that we do have privacy and that for the government to come into our home is a violation. An intrusion of our person, our property.
Let's get a view on privacy from AJ in Potsdam, New York. AJ, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I think I would echo the previous caller. I value my sense of personal privacy, and I will share with those people whom I choose those aspects of my life that I wish to do. If I were going to deal with Amazon.com online, absolutely I'm aware that they keep a personal profile of their customers. I consent to that explicitly when I trade with them. If there were things that I didn't want them to know about, I wouldn't be going to their site. I think the state motto of the state of New Hampshire pretty much sums it up. Live free or die. And that's basic Americanism, Judge. We Americans, many of us, most of us, I should think, have a sense of personal privacy. If your car is broken into, if your home is broken into, one feels violated. If I were to find somebody looking through my keyhole, they might be on the receiving end of the ice pick I shove through it.
All right, AJ. Well, thank you very much for that. Judge, is what AJ is saying a common American notion of privacy, or is it hopelessly sentimental?
Yeah, it gets hopelessly sentimental. I do make a distinction between actually people coming into your home and rummaging around. I mean, you know, that's obviously, no one wants strangers in his home rummaging around. And the kind of electronic surveillance, which is pervasive.
Joining us from Newburyport, Mass, is Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I have to go with the gentleman that was talking about New Hampshire. First off, I'm African-American, and I'm scrutinized, followed, tailed all the time in the area I drive around in, and it bothers me. I don't want anyone else's security to interfere with my freedom.
But what Judge Posner is saying is that you're already there. You're in that world, pal. This idea that you're private is like, that's fiction.
Well, I don't believe it's fiction for me as a person. I believe in the Fourth Amendment, and if any changes need to be made, aside from that, we need to do it with an amendment, not just some little program that congressmen decide. Because I don't trust anyone in the government, running the government at this point. I trust my government and its form, for sure. But the people that are running it right now, I have a lot of doubts about. And I don't want anyone messing with my privacy.
All right, Tim, thank you very much. Professor Chemerinsky, you know, is this an impediment to making the kinds of changes that Judge Posner is talking about, this lack of trust? And does a trust in MI5 help the British?
Well, I do think it's important to have government institutions that we trust, and I think it's important for government institutions to be able to protect our security. What I've never been convinced of is that we can't do that in a way that's consistent with the Constitution. Let me respond to what Judge Posner said a moment ago. When I'm speaking to my wife by telephone and we're discussing some of the most intimate aspects of our lives, I expect that that's a private conversation. There's things we're talking about that we don't want anyone other than us to know about. And the government should only be listening if the government can meet the requirements of the federal statutes in the Fourth Amendment.
But I guess the question is, do the British have that same expectation? In other words, when they're having intimate conversations, do they expect that somewhere MI5 might be able to listen to what they're doing if they have a reason?
Well, I think there are expectations of privacy. That's obviously a different system. It doesn't have the Constitution as we do, but there are limits on the ability of MI5 or British law enforcement to listen in on conversations. I think the key question for those who would want to relax the ability of the government to monitor conversations is to show that this is necessary in order to protect security. So far as we know, MI5 was able to break what was going on in Britain with regard to the airplanes, not through electronic surveillance primarily, but through traditional law enforcement means: infiltration, monitoring, gathering of the kinds of information necessary to prevent the crime.
Well, I want to get a response from Judge Posner, yeah, but just for a moment, I want to bring into the conversation someone who certainly has firsthand knowledge of the operational efficacy of the FBI. Colleen Rowley joins us now from Apple Valley, Minnesota. She's a retired special agent and former Minneapolis Division Counsel for the FBI, who retired in 2004. She's currently running for Congress as the Democratic Farmer Labor candidate for Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District. In 2002, you may remember, she exposed lapses in the investigation of suspected Al-Qaeda operative Zacharias Moussaoui. Thanks for joining us, Colleen Rowley.
Hello, everyone. You have an interesting conversation going.
Well, thank you. What do you think about the idea of using MI5 as a model, and would it have prevented any of the kinds of things that you blew the whistle on back in 2003?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish. I think MI5 and even other European intelligence gathering agencies are good models. However, I don't think in the United States that the FBI should be split into an MI5 situation.
What about a separate organization?
I don't believe they should split, no, for a lot of reasons, actually. One is, of course, MI5, one of the callers just noted that, you know, there is a certain amount of trust developed in MI5. Part of that reason is it's been around since 1909. When you disrupt either through fission or fusion, you know, putting agencies together or splitting them apart, the disruption itself, and of course we can hardly afford that kind of disruption right now in our efforts to combat terrorism, and you don't have that level of trust. That's built up over a long period of time. Even going back to the 1960s, these abuses of civil liberties that occurred that resulted in our FISA law. You know, it's taken a long time to get past the church committee's findings and finally to get, you know, a certain level of trust. My background actually is in electronic surveillance on criminal matters. One of the callers advocated sticking with the Fourth Amendment. And you see that over a period of time since we began to conduct electronic surveillance on criminal matters, that it actually works quite well and most people do have a level of trust in it.
Do you think that based on the arrests that were made in London and Pakistan most recently, that you're seeing a triumph of legal authority and a different way of doing things in England, or a triumph of traditional investigative techniques that maybe has it over the FBI?
Well, I've pointed actually to the European intelligence and criminal systems in dealing with terrorism as the model. And to the extent that they have not abandoned the criminal mode in the United States, I've actually been in debates with people that say 9/11 has changed everything. We can no longer rely on our criminal prosecution as a method of dealing with terrorism. And I've argued the opposite point, that actually our constitutional framework has evolved in such a way that it does allow us quite effectively to deal with terrorism. So I think that the Europeans are, you know, in this last case actually is a pretty good case study and point that we don't have to, and certainly the military mode is the most ludicrous, because obviously terrorists are scattered throughout the world and you can't just drop bombs on places like London and Madrid, et cetera, to try to get the handful of terrorists that might be scattered. So I think we need to be surgical and precise. And what is more surgical and precise than law enforcement and maybe combined with some intelligence?
And particularly human intelligence, it sounds like you're saying.
Well, you know, we talked about infiltration, and of course, people may recall that infiltration and use of human intelligence also has its potential abuses. The Whitey Bulger case is a case in point. You know, so there are issues there. The need here is for accountability and compliance and judiciousness, and all techniques can be abused. But we definitely need that kind of oversight, and not, you know, an excuse saying, well, the so-called, you know, war on terrorism or 9/11 changed everything. I am with all the people who say let's get our heads on straight and see what works and see what has stood the test of time.
Well, Colleen Raleigh, thanks for joining us, and good luck in your congressional race.
Thank you.
That was Colleen Raleigh in 2002. Former FBI agent exposed lapses in the investigation of suspected al-Qaeda operative Zacharias Moussaoui. Judge Richard Posner, she's certainly an advocate of MI5. Talk for a minute about this issue of trust that the callers have alluded to and Professor Chemerinsky has alluded to. Is it really an important element in thinking about radical change in the way we do surveillance, domestic surveillance in the United States?
Oh, yeah, I think it's extremely important. And, of course, one of the problems, you know, we have partisan politics and the strong antipathy in many quarters to the Bush administration carries over and creates kind of general distrust of the whole government, which I think is unwarranted because the people actually engaged in these surveillance activities and so on, they're civil servants, they're not the political leadership. There's no indication so far that there have been any abuses of the kind that the CIA and the FBI committed in up until the early 70s and then were exposed by the Church and Pike committees. And that's, you know, something we want to worry about. We have rules against it, but we don't want to be paranoid about our government and as a result become even more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. Let me just add, I don't propose, you know, breaking up the FBI or anything like that. But I do not agree with Ms. Rowley that the criminal process is adequate to deal with terrorism. First of all, you know, the criminal process operates by deterrence and by incapacitation. Well, deterrence doesn't work very well with terrorists. They're fanatics. Some of them are suicidal and so on. They're very difficult to deter. And incapacitation doesn't work very well because, you know, you can catch and lock up terrorists, but the supply of terrorists seems virtually infinite. So this is one of the problems with the drug war. So if you have a very large supply of potential criminals, removing some of them into prison doesn't help you. So we have to use other techniques. I don't mean military stuff, but I do mean kind of standard intelligence techniques. Try to penetrate a network, find out how extensive it is. Once you learn, you know, about the plot, disrupting it is relatively simple. But you have to have people who are focused on prevention and not on criminal prosecution. Criminal prosecution comes too late. I mean, suppose one of those 19 suicide bombers in 9/11 had survived and been tried and sentenced to death and executed. What good would that have done?
Indeed. Mary is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you. You know, you started off talking about the 9/11 commission testimony. You should go back through that testimony. You can find out why we weren't prepared, why we don't have these critical languages. Because when people applied to the FBI or the CIA who could speak those languages, they were turned down because these organizations want to keep that old boy network. In other words, it has to remain white and male so that you don't have these people who can infiltrate these organizations. And I would suggest to the judge that he'd read Hannah Arendt. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correctly.
Hannah Arendt.
Yes, and the way that the Nazis operated. They operated where they got the telephone man to tap your telephone, your neighbor to spy on you. MI5 is not adequate for our so-called organization culture.
But, you know, I agree with you that there's a problem of not hiring enough people who have the ethnic background and linguistic skills that we need. But it's not a discrimination problem. You know, 40% of the CIA is 40% of the employees of the CIA are women. It's a bureaucratic risk aversion. It's the fear that they hire someone who has, you know, contacts abroad, and he turns out to be a mole or a spy or something. Bureaucratic risk aversion is a serious problem. It's a serious criminal problem. And Mr. Watson, earlier in the program, mentioned this. The police are very reluctant to delay arresting suspects until they can, you know, learn the full extent of the plot, because they're afraid that the person will do something, you know, that they'll lose sight of him while they're trying to follow him. He'll commit a crime, and then they'll be police will be blamed and called lax and so on. So it's you know, we have extremely difficult problems of properly motivating government officers to be efficient.
So the issue is, even if the expertise is top-notch, the incentives are all wrong, and that really keeps things from happening at the time that they should be happening, in your view. Marie from Providence, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling because I do think the English model is a good one. I agree with almost 90% of what Judge Posner has said, and I do want to add that a group of people like the English model should have people of character, multilinguistic, and they cannot be political appointees. They have to pass and have a high degree of intelligence, which is what intelligence is about. It's not about who you know. It's about performing these duties. And this we very much need here in this country.
All right, Marie, thank you very much for calling. Professor Chemerinsky, you know, we certainly see a lot of people who feel much better knowing that there's more surveillance. Do they have a reason to feel good based on the track record of the FBI and the expertise problems that you've talked about?
Well, surveillance doesn't do anything by itself unless the information is used well. I mean, listening to millions of conversations doesn't help us unless there's a good capacity for sifting through, finding, and then applying the information. I want to agree very strongly with what Judge Posner says. Our law enforcement mechanism has traditionally been about solving crime. Laws have been about deterring, incapacitating. We need to come up with a better apparatus for preventing. My concern in creating a new agency like MI5 is whether or not we're going to create turf wars between that agency and existing agencies. I think the question is, can we avoid that, as former Agent Raleigh was talking about, by orienting part of the FBI to doing a better job to gathering information, to preventing crime? That, to me, is the key question. Yeah.
Judge Posner, can I ask you a question? It's one that runs the risk of you dismissing me as one of your annoying grad students. But and I used to go to the University of Chicago, so I know of what I speak. Does it surprise you?
Salt and alumnus.
There we go. Does it surprise you that as a sitting judge at this stage in your career, you would be arguing strenuously that this whole criminal justice business is an impediment, a dangerous impediment to being secure? Which is exactly not what the framers had in mind when they designed the justice system as a check on state power.
No. I mean, yeah, I've been a judge for many years. It means I've observed things inside the about. One of the things, for example, I've observed is the futility of the war on drugs. Right, the war on drugs. This is use of criminal enforce. Actually, there's there are military components also in Colombia. But basically, it's a criminal law enforcement program of dealing with, a kind of activity which is sort of like terrorism. You know, it's extensive, it's well-financed, it's secret, it's gang activity, it's actually international. I've seen that. Well, it's failed, right? The war on drugs has failed. So that shows the limitations of the criminal justices. Now, the framers, the framers were very able people, right? But that's the 18th century. They didn't know about drug gangs, and they didn't know about, global terrorism in the era of advanced electronic communications.
So, and they didn't have to take their shoes off to get on an airplane,
You can't expect an 18th century constitution to fit all 21st century problems. So the way we deal with that in law, we have flexible interpretation of the Constitution, which I agree with.
Contemplate some
originalists. I'm sure you're not
right.
either.
Well, we contemplate changes we have during this conversation. Thank you very much, Judge Posner and Professor Chemerinsky.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Richard Posner, judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals and lecturer at University of Chicago Law School, and Erwin Chemerinsky, professor of law and political science at Duke. I'm John Hockenberry, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. You can continue our conversation online at onpoint.org. This is On Point.